lapsed funds are lost on that operating budget, so you really start to work on it.
Another thing that bugs me, one-time appropriations, you know, and, I don't know, you don't see where those cut off, and then, but the budget doesn't, take that into consideration. Seems like you carry that prior figure and add to it. I don't know how many one-time appropriations we had in this fish and game budget, you know.
Some of those initial figures just come out of legislative intent, I'll ask for $100,000 for a chicken queer, and it just don't, it's just not enough, it's my guess, and all of a sudden you find out it costs, $600,000. That's part of the problem.
I understand that, but if you've carried something, a figure like that since 1970, it seems like somewhere is the information ought to be provided, you know, that this situation exists, you know.
Write me a letter, tell me you haven't got enough money, and I'll, try to get.
Well, I know how we screwed around with the Annan Fishway until we finally got it in the budget. At one time, we had the ability to get it all paid for by federal funds, but they fooled around until they lost that.
Well, I wanna close this thing off in about 8 minutes.
Less than that.
Less than that, yeah.
Anything, Merle, Pete?
No, I think I answered, got all my questions answered.
I know you're not through, Ernie, but I wanna go lunch.
Can you give me a figure on what the Fort Walter fishery was worth? In commercial fish market?
Certainly.
And what the cost of the operation was down there?
Fort Walter?
Thank you, Jay.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Morgan, I didn't get nowhere.
Yeah, I'd like to have some word back, what your thoughts are on that, rolling that limited into.
How many federal employees, full-time federal employees you got in the budget?
I'd like to know within a couple of weeks if you have any strong thoughts, 'cause I wanna close this budget.
Full-time federal positions.
Come back, just anytime, just let me know whether you're gonna do it or not, 'cause it'll reflect on some of these.
Mr. Hogan, I can't answer that right off the top of my head, but I'll develop that information for you and transmit it up to the committee.
Well, I thank you for coming. Try to close this budget as fast as we can.
Sorry, I have a core when you get one.
Okay.
All right, Marsha Hubbard will speak to the fiscal, and if there's any further program questions, Dr. Schrader will speak to the program questions.
Okay, the first matter on the agenda will be Senate Bill 129, relating to medical assistance for needy persons. Kathy Loy is here, perhaps, somebody might just very briefly set out what the change of the program would be, and then we can go into fiscal aspects after that. Marsha?
The, Senate Bill 129, assists, the department and the division in collecting reimbursement, on services that we provide to people 21 and under who are receiving psychiatric services at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. This is a program that's been in effect a number of years, and we have always claimed reimbursement under this program. But we have difficulty with it because under our current law, we have to prove that each case is medically disabled. And the guidelines and the standards for that are really quite flexible. To give you an example, it just says that you can consider a person under 21 disabled if he is if his condition is likely to last a year or has lasted a year, and you're to do it sort of by analogy using the standard of an adult. So it's an area where there's a lot of debate. The passage of 129 will allow us to claim reimbursement on this group of people without having to prove in each individual instance that they're medically disabled.
Thank you, Dr. Strader. Are there questions as to the program aspect of this bill by any of the members of the committee? If not, Marsha Hubbard, comment, I guess, on the fiscal aspects. Is that correct?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Approximately 22% of the API's budget is funded with interagency receipts from the Medicaid program. There were two programs authorized for operation in 78. They were an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded and an inpatient psychiatric services for those who are under 21 and over 65. Primarily, the individuals in the inpatient psychiatric service fall into the under 21 area. That's the area that's under consideration today. The program started in FY75 and has been claiming receipts since that time. In the fall of last year, we went under a Medicaid audit for a full three-year audit, and they have deferred all of our claims for those 3 years based on a belief that they need to review in each individual medical file. Consequently, all of our interagency receipts, our Medicaid receipts for those 3 years are in question, and our ability to actually claim for this year is deferred. With the passage of this bill, we'll be able to, we feel, categorically determine each and all of these individuals who are under 21 and meet the income standards as eligible for Medicaid reimbursement and claim. It would have no change then on the percentage of the budget which we had projected as claimable. On the other hand, there are two facts that have occurred. We projected 25 individuals as being eligible, and we have 30. We projected a rate of $101 a day, and we've gone to $165 a day. So there will be, if these people are determined eligible under the federal rule, more federal reimbursement than we had anticipated. The fiscal note shows an increase of $337,000 for 78 and an increase of $677,000 for FY79. However, the department's asked that the fiscal note not be passed at this time until the federal audit is completed. It wouldn't really matter whether the fiscal note was passed or not. Findings are against the state, and for that period of time in FY78 that we were using the present determination, then we wouldn't make all of these receipts. I think I just confused you, but for the first half of the year, we have claimed these receipts. They have not given them to us, even with the passage of this bill. They may not give them to us for the first half of the year. They will give them to us for the second half of the fiscal year.
Okay. Mr. Meekins,
why is it that you only claim patients under 21 and over 65?
You have to meet eligibility standards for public assistance. Eligibility standards for public assistance are that you have to be eligible for categorical aid. You have to either be disabled, blind, elderly, or on aid of families with dependent children. And these individuals would have to meet the income standard for AFDC.
The other thing is that the feds don't allow us to claim on the people between 21 and 65.
Well, how are they covered then?
They're not covered by Medicaid when they're in a public institution.
We pay that state this. So the under 21 are really under AFDC.
They would be considered eligible for AFDC.
21 is the, when they become an adult or whatever.
All right, Mr. Green.
Does this require that the parents of the person under 21 be receiving AFDC, like, let's say, well,
or income eligible? They would have to be eligible for it.
You couldn't. I know that this is a problem for all, no matter what your income level, that daily care in any kind of facility is extremely expensive. And I have constituents, or I don't know, in Anchorage, who receive bills for thousands and thousands of dollars for care of people in API. But you're saying that these federal funds are not available?
They're not available.
If they are other than actually receiving AFDC, or eligible for it.
Or eligible.
They're eligible if they meet one of the categories of eligibility. AFDC is one of them. Being disabled is another category, and that's why, you know, like being blind or disabled or these various categories. That's why we have to individually prove that each case is disabled.
Well, okay, then under present law, that technically a family, a middle-income family, could have a child under 21 receiving aid, then,
yes,
because that person is deemed disabled.
Yes,
under
and
the Medicaid Act.
Yeah, and his and would meet the income standards as well.
Well, there's, in addition to being
medically disabled. For example, if the child had a trust fund, $500,000 his grandfather gave, he wouldn't be, even though he was disabled, he wouldn't be eligible.
But you're talking about the disabled. Are the parents' income included in that?
Yes, it is. If you're under the age of 21, you count your parents' income. If you're over the age of 21, there's no service available to for Medicaid reimbursement. In this case, even if you're disabled, if you're between the ages of 21 and 65, it's just an uncovered service they won't pay for in a public institution. Primarily because that's the bulk of people who are in these types of institutions. In a lot of cases, it would be too costly for the federal government to sort of cost if they're in a position. A middle income family could seek assistance under the GR program if it's an intact family or under catastrophic illness. If it's not, there's free care also.
Free care what?
Also for the
family. Mr. Meekins and Mr. Swanson.
How is it that we can, it seems like a pretty neat trick to just pass this bill and then all the eligibility questions are solved. How does that, I don't quite understand why that is. Is that a function of the complexity of their regulations?
Yes, it is, right. We did the same thing at Harborview. Very similar. When we first started collecting Title 19 in Harborview, we only did so on the basis of their being disabled or otherwise categorically eligible. And then we passed, I think in 74, the reasonable classification.
But right now, I mean, they say they'll, as long as they fit into these categories correctly, then they consider that they're eligible. You make the determination at this point, but you have to do it on a case-by-case basis. You have to say, oh, you have to make do some sort of,
and they have the option of coming in and reviewing that and questioning our determination.
But if you say that there's a reasonable connection between entrance into the facility and being disabled, they won't question it?
Well, what they allow us to take that position by this reasonable classification, essentially saying that if the person is in there and meets the income standard, it's reasonable to assume that he's disabled, and they'll allow us to claim reimbursement.
But I mean, what's interesting is that is that they make a different determination on some of these people, or at least they might contest some of them under one case and not on another, and it's just a shell game, really, because it's the same people, same condition.
Correct.
I think
shell game moving an age group around, not just an individual. The situation is that we're looking at 21-year-olds or under, and in order to determine whether they're disabled, you're supposed to be able to say, Social Security says, I want to know whether this person can work or not work before I'm going to make them eligible. Well, when you're looking at a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old, they're not in the labor force anyway, so you just get into a semantic game. Can they go to school? Can they not go to school? Does that really work? So by moving that whole age group over into a different clinical situation, that is just saying that they're there for service, and if they're there for service, they must be sick, then you're able to make the claim. It is a battle of semantics, but they're moving a whole age group, not an individual.
That's right.
We just might add one more comment. Because of this their own regulations. If we pass this, then we will be able to go back to them on these 350 cases from back, going back to 1975 that they're questioning, and say essentially, well, you know, your classification is either reasonable or it isn't. And if it's reasonable, then stop hassling us about these past cases. And I think that they will. That's my personal opinion.
Mr. Swanson had a question back there some time ago.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would like to explain to me what the 10%, what the 10% growth factor is. Is this in your fiscal note? Is that 10% inflation factor, or is that a 10% increase in the amount of people that will service in the next year, from this year to next year?
From next year. Your Medicaid reimbursement rate is set on the pro rata cost of operating a bed in the institution. Consequently, we operated 200 beds for $6,007,078 and have a Medicaid receipt of $165. We have asked for a budget of $7,004,000. That's 10% higher than last year's budget. Consequently, it would be a 10% increase in reimbursement.
And each year from here on, we go along, we're going to get a 10% increase in the cost of a bed.
You would only get it if your budget was in fact increasing. It's a reimbursable. They prove that you actually expended this amount of money on these patients.
And the cost of the hospital cost 10% more from last year?
That's the budget request.
What would happen if we didn't give you the 10%?
If you maintained the hospital at its current budget level, well, it would have no impact on the Medicaid rate.
The hospital would just say, well, we got 10% increase last year in this program, so next year we're going to just charge you 10% more.
Well, this year, the bulk of the increase in the API budget is the result of the salary increases which were passed. Almost 80% of the budget is in personal services. And we had a salary increase of it's about 5.5%. And you can see where the line item increases have been. It would require the reduction of staff.
This is a 10% inflation factor then, when you got a 6% increase in wages.
Then 4% above the 6% increase in staff.
I think most all of our budgets are being held at about 6%.
That's right.
And I think that, Mr. Chairman, we should look at any 10% inflation factor in any bill, and including this one.
I might observe, Mr. Swanson, that the request of the department was to hold the fiscal note anyway. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I would think that we can deal with that later, Mr. Meek.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand, though, that this is for reimbursable services, and whether or not we granted them the increase in their budget, they could still justifiably, but in any case, they could claim that their costs have gone up and they would be reimbursed from the federal government based on whatever they could show the federal government, demonstrate to the federal government what their costs are, and it wouldn't matter what we believe, really.
No, it's correct? Controlled at your level. It's the only part of the Medicaid program that is, in fact, controlled at your level. You could take a pro rata share of the institution and shove it against that particular 20 individuals or 30 individuals and say, I spend a higher percentage of my budget for that 30 individuals and try and get a bigger claim. But when they cost settle you, they go in and say, how much did you spend on the operation of this facility? Then we'll give you a bed day rate and we'll pay for that. If there's some special services you render to these individuals, then we might pay for those services above it. But primarily, if you're controlling costs in the medical field, the only place to control it is the overall expenditure of the facility. And that there's no way that the department can go around and claim money that they didn't have to spend in the first place, because it's all reimbursable.
Yeah, but I mean, if we doubled your budget, you wouldn't get twice as much from that.
If we spent twice as much for each bed, we would. That's basically why they're trying to get some welfare control on state institutions too.
If we cut your budget and you had to reduce the number of persons, patients,
then we only collect less.
But kept the same per capita.
Couldn't keep the same per capita.
Well, if we did,
if you had
we
a vacancy rate, you could. If you have a high vacancy rate, you could jack up your bed cost, but you'd be charging it for fewer patients, and therefore you would get less.
Well, I understand that problem, but I'm just saying, theoretically, they would, whatever, I mean, I'm just wondering what happens, what the effect of our changes in the budget are in...
They're significant.
In how they view your per capita cost that they're reversing.
They are significant. It's the only place that there is control. If you took, as you did last year, $1 million out of this budget, then our rate went down, our projected rate went down. Because we were going to spend less on each individual bed.
But to a certain extent, that's accurate, right? I mean,
that's
to a certain
correct.
Extent, you do cut back on what you provide for each person, right? Mm-hmm. But on another hand, there's certain fixed costs that would, and you would actually increase.
Per bed cost.
It might have a reverse effect.
That's right.
May I comment?
Go ahead.
But you know, I think the bottom line is that the cost system that the pay system requires that you do a cost report, and you can only claim for Medicaid for each individual eligible client what you spent the cost of doing the service, and so. And that is a percentage of the total operating budget of the facility.
You also have to prove that you're charging every client exactly the same amount of money. So it'd be difficult for us to take two sets of clients that we're receiving pretty much the same service and charge somebody differently.
If we increase, you know, on the one hand, if we provided better services, you know, maybe lower, more staff or something like that, that would, I can see where. That would make sense, but we're improving the situation, and therefore it makes sense for them to reimburse us on a higher level because we're providing better service. But what if we increase the staff there and we just pay more? You know, it's just regular inflation. Do they take that? They'll do that too.
Yeah. That's an actual cost.
If there was an indirect cost, like you wanted to run an advocacy group out of an institution of some kind. You couldn't write that cost off.
Right.
There are certain costs that you can include.
Okay. Are there further questions by the members of the committee? Lisa, do you have any questions that you'd like?
No.
Feel free.
And ask questions.
Mr. Greeny.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move and ask unanimous consent. We report out Senate Bill 129.
Okay.
I didn't hear the whole motion.
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
The whole motion is I move and ask unanimous consent we report out Senate Bill 129.
Does that include the fiscal note?
No,
it does not include the fiscal note.
Is there objection to Mr. Greening's motion? There's no objection. Motion carries. How many good passes do we have on the bill? The majority did pass on lights. I'd like to thank Ms. Lloyd, Ms. Hubbard, and Dr. Schrader for appearing here on behalf of the department. And also, all right, the next matter that we'll take up would be House Bill 133, Municipal Land Bill. Now,
we don't need any debate on this, do we?
Sorry about that.
I'd like to review the status of the bill before, while we're still passing around the bill report on Senate Bill 129. The members of the committee will remember that we took this bill up in the closing days of the last legislative session, and the members just felt like that we didn't have enough information and that there was some substantial disagreement in how to proceed here, and because it came so late in the session, it was deferred until this year. I think unless the members have some serious objections, and you may have serious objections, what I'd like to do is not to go over the entire bill and what it means and the history of it and all that sort of thing, and just assume that the members know that. Now, I don't want to assume that unless you do know what it is. Is there any member of the committee that would like a full review of the bill again? Because it's an important bill.
Okay.
about 133?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Russ?
Well, I'm not sure, I think I know the basic, we heard some really good testimony on what the basic point of the bill was, but we never did go over it, you know, paragraph by paragraph, and I don't know that that's important because I haven't done it, but maybe somebody else does know.
Well, I was speaking of the history behind the bill and the reasons why the bill was drafted in this form. We had a pretty extensive discussion that last spring, and I thought perhaps that was suffice for spring.
Mr. Chairman, the question is, do you have any intention or plans to report this bill out of committee today?
If it's the committee's desire to do so, yes. I don't know if the committee would find it had enough information to make a decision.
The reason, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the reason I ask the question, because as I did last year, I have some serious questions in my mind about the whole philosophical approach as far as the bill's concerned, and I want to examine and have a look at those if it's sooner or later. Chairman's intent that we should move the bill out today, why, on my part, it's going to require taking a look at
it. In answer to that, it would be the chair's intent to proceed with the bill as soon as the committee is ready, but I don't intend to hold the bill. In other words, if we're not ready today, I'd like to perhaps set Friday, unless people are taking off on a long weekend and digging into plans, and maybe we can't do that. In any event, early next week, I don't want to sit on the bill any longer. I think we ought to take some decisive action on this bill. Mr. Shaker.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. I've got a proposed substitute that I'd like to take a look at, but I just got the thing early this morning, and I think I would agree with Mr. Freeman and yourself, Mr. Chairman, to work something out, say, early next week or early the end of this week, to give the members time enough to look at it.
But I think it's a very important piece of legislation, and a lot of communities have a lot riding on the bill, and we're into a situation here where I think it would be in order to release lands to these municipalities, and hopefully they'll release it in turn to the citizens. I wouldn't intend to hold the bill for very long. I think we ought to bring it to vote and take it to the floor for whatever action is appropriate. I'd like to have at least a preliminary show of hands of the people who would expect to testify on this bill. I'm assuming that Mike Smith will. Who else is here to testify on the bill? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Mike, would you like to make an addition? Mr. Duncan.
Before we begin, are we taking testimony on the bill we had before in the last session?
Yes.
Or another proposal?
No, we're taking testimony on the bill that was drafted by the Community and Regional Affairs Committee, which came to this committee. That's the bill that we're addressing. If there are
those numbers
proposed, yeah. If there are proposed changes, then of course we'll consider those in order in which they're proposed. Mike, would you lead off for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Smith. I'm Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I think perhaps the best service I could be to the committee after a few brief statements would be to answer any questions that may particularly exist. I'd like to briefly sum up, as the state administration sees it, where things were left last year and basically what's happened in the interim. As Chairman Cooper mentioned, at the end of last year, it was decided, because of some differences that did exist among members of the committee, that the bill should be assigned to a subcommittee during the interim, and it was so assigned. from the state's position, we had at the end of last session really one community which had not indicated concurrence with the legislation. That was the North Slope Borough. As members of the committee are aware, we made several attempts at talking to the North Slope Borough, and I believe we copied you with appropriate copies of that correspondence. With respect to the contacts with the North Slope Borough, we had very few until just recently. And at this time, in fact, yesterday and today, in Point Barrow, representatives of the Department of Natural Resources planning staff are meeting with their counterparts with the borough in a totally apolitical atmosphere, and that they're not, at least the people that I've sent up there, are not really aware of the bill as such. But mainly to go up there on the basis of looking at lands that might be appropriate for the municipality to actually select and have under its jurisdiction as the basis for perhaps a compromise, as opposed to arguing abstract figure totals without any indication of where these selections might occur. The other contacts which have occurred during the interim have been between the state and the other municipalities involved. And with the exception, as I mentioned, of North Slope and perhaps the Juneau borough, I feel that all other communities that were certainly the ones listed in the bill itself, all the other major boroughs, have been not only contacted, they have reviewed the situation, have indicated their support for HB 133 as it presently exists for this committee. And it was mentioned that the draft that I will be referring to as the, quote, existing draft, unquote, is the one reported out by the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee on, I believe it was May 4th of last year. Other than that,
Well, I have one question. Was there some amendatory language that you would propose to the committee?
Yes. Sorry, I neglected that. I transmitted to you a letter, I believe it's dated February 10th, which has with it attached 8 amendments. These were distributed fairly widely among the affected communities. They are all minor and technical. I don't believe that there is any controversy involved. A number of them are required simply because the bill is now a year later being considered. Agreements were such that they were based upon a 1977 passage. Others are just technical and minor amendments of language.
Okay, and you did send me a note dated January 31st, including a new fiscal note.
That's correct. That right. is, again, based upon certain changes that occurred since last session.
All right, Mr. Freeman.
In the amendment, reading through your letter to the chairman dated February 10th, I don't find any, recommended amendments for changes in the figures on page 1 of the committee substitute for 133. That's, in other words, the entitlement for the borough of so many acres.
That's correct.
You have no recommended changes to that.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I'd like to state, so the committee members will know, that I did get a wire from the Kenai Borough, Peninsula Borough, today in full support of the bill as it was reported out of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Mr. Meek.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to sort of make a comment to Mr. Smith that I do understand that a lot of municipalities favor the bill. In fact, in Anchorage, when we went to the meeting on legislative issues for the upcoming session, they had as part of their program support for this bill. But you know, one of the sort of paradoxical, I guess, is that when they did support it, but on the other hand, when it was a little bit discussed and talking about the sort of the inequity in regards to population, if you looked at it in terms of population versus how many people, what municipalities are getting, what number of acres, they were upset about that. And I think that, I sort of have this reluctance to, as I said last year, to jump into this bill, even though I understand the legal reasons for it and the contractual nature of it, and that if we try to do anything, we're going to have to increase the problem, really, rather than decrease it. And we're not going to have to be able to bring anybody down. We're going to have to bring everybody else up. And if you did it on a strictly per capita basis, which is what I would have wanted to do if I had drafted the original we wouldn't, I don't know, we'd get into billions of dollars out of the state treasury to Anchorage and other communities. We tried to get them to equal value to, say, Mat-Su. So I understand that problem, but I still have this real reluctance. I guess it's, maybe it's because it's a political year, but I can just see, you know, see a question arising in the public's mind, even if it doesn't arise in their representatives in the municipality, that, you know, whereas Fairbanks gets 155,000 acres or whatever it was, I haven't looked at the bill in a long time, and Mat-Su 350,000, Anchorage gets 20,000. And I don't really know what to do about that, but I just, it's still something that concerns me. I think it is a real inequitable piece of legislation, and you've made, you know, in the past, a good case for why it needs to be passed, regardless of that problem. But, I still have concern about that.
The point you bring out, I mean, I can understand your concern, and all I can do is reiterate, I think, what we commented last year, that the purpose of our attempting to reach the settlement on this is not to try to justify why one municipality is getting one figure and another is getting another, but rather to settle up under a 15-year-old law which was defective at its creation. The only analogy I can think of is that maybe the natives, descendants of the original inhabitants of Manhattan Island, are upset that the Alaska natives got $1 billion for 40 million acres of land when they only got $24 worth of trinkets, and therefore something should be done to help them. I mean, those were agreements that were made at a given period of time, and what we're doing now is just interpreting what those are to settle that. If in fact there is some feeling of tremendous inequity or something like that, perhaps that needs to be handled in some future operation. But the purpose now is to settle up the existing law as it is written and to solve the problems that it has caused as such, making certain changes where there are certain communities which are so way out of line, particularly the situations in the southeast, to handle those. But to attempt, any attempt at setting the other situations up would be, what you say, almost impossible because of the billions of dollars out of the treasury or fantastic quantities of land involved. There's no simple way of doing it.
Okay. Mr. Green, could you just refresh my memory as to what the original act provided?
The original act provided very succinctly that municipalities, certain municipalities, basically then only the boroughs since expanded to cities, were entitled to select 10% of the, quote, vacant, unappropriated, unreserved, end quote, state land in their boundaries. And other than that, it said nothing. For, well, 13 years until the department, in conjunction with the municipalities, began working on this approximately a year and a half ago. For the interim period of time, no regulations were ever adopted which would interpret that in a way that could be somewhat equitably applied to all communities. The result is that there was no time deadline within which this was to happen. There was no definition of what vacant, unappropriated, unreserved lands meant. Meanwhile, the legislature, the state was selecting more lands, the legislature was creating certain parks, refuges, what have you, during this period of time. The state was disposing of other lands, both to communities and to private individuals. The result was just a tremendous uneven management, logically, of lands within the various communities.
And how did the act address the question of allocation among the municipalities of that 10%?
No, each individual municipality was to get 10% of the land, vacant land, within its own borders, which obviously at the time it was done, I mean, was such that the bigger municipalities, Mat-Su right then was vested with a very big entitlement because they had very big borders. Anchorage correspondingly smaller, Juneau even smaller.
That thing was sort of doubly ridiculous in a sense because in the first place it didn't have any kind of adjustment for population, so that if all the land in all the municipalities was vacant, unreserved, and unappropriated, it would still be a direct function of the largeness of the municipality and have nothing to do with the value of the municipality, the number of people, or any other kind of indicator which it should have taken into consideration. Because there are some small municipalities that, you know, could really use the land perhaps. And so it doesn't have anything to do with fairness. And secondly, the as you explained before, they didn't all have the same amounts of, the same percentage of their land was not vacant, unreserved, and unappropriated. Some very large municipalities and boroughs that don't have any. And so it was biased from fairness doubly. And first because
the indicator that was used wasn't, didn't make any sense, really. And secondly, because it was somewhat arbitrary, coincidental, how much land within any municipality might be vacant unreserved and unappropriated. So it's, now that's where we've gotten to this crazy quote. I mean, all these numbers are logical in one sense, but they're, you know, when you look at them just from the larger view, they're very, very arbitrary. And whether Anchorage should get 20 or 40 or 16 or 2 or whatever, it's just sort of picking numbers out of a hat in a larger sense.
Mr.
Chairman, I don't know whether it's a proper question to pose to Mr. Smith, but is it your contention, notwithstanding the fact that the original formula is written out, that absolutely ridiculous? In other words, I'll give you an example. Under the laws that stand today, the borough that I live in would get 156 acres, and Matsu would get 355,000. Is it your contention, notwithstanding the fact that that's patently and obviously ridiculous, that it can't be changed? I think I know your answer, because you're proposing to change it upward for some communities. Is it your contention that it could be changed downward as well as upward?
Well, certainly it has been changed upward in certain cases. For instance, your municipality, because of the fact it doesn't apply. I don't mean to contend strictly a case of law, and I would refer you to your legislative council, but it's our understanding or interpretation that when this act was passed, those communities became vested with certain rights, and it would be a question of state constitutional law whether the legislature could in fact take those rights away from their communities. Now, if it's felt that a municipality is not a person under the American and state constitutions, you may be able to. If they are considered a person under those constitutions, you probably could not without some kind of just compensation. But again, I leave that to the committee. The agreement that has been arrived at by all the municipalities involved was that we would not attempt to do that, that we would settle up on the basis of the law as it was written.
Okay, Mr. Freeman.
I understand you, and I hear you clearly when you're talking about what you agrees to with the municipalities, but the municipalities are not the one that has to sit here and make the decision. So, you know, the municipalities, being reasonable people, are going to ask for everything and all they can get, which is their proper job. But that doesn't mean that we can, people sit around this table, can shirk the responsibility for having trying to come up with something that's halfway sane and reasonable. And, you know, what this bill proposes, it's ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. It's ridiculous. I never voted for it. But then I noticed when you talk about the statutes that provided for the entitlement, you say in your letter to the chairman, you say one obvious implication of the legislature's adoption of committee substitute for House Bill 133 would be the fact that by Section 5 of the proposed bill, the original Municipal Selection Act, S-29-18-19-20-18-420, would be repealed. If you can repeal it for one reason, my question was, can you repeal it for another one? You say, as I understood, your answer was that you can repeal it if you give everybody more, but you can't repeal it if you want to give some of them less. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, you could repeal it if, in fact, you are either holding people constant or giving them more, and you could not repeal it if you were attempting to give it to them less. But again, as I say, that's a legal question. I refer to your own legal counsel. My estimation would be if the legislature did do that it would ultimately have to be decided in the Supreme Court, certainly with respect to the whole reason we worked so hard to get this before you, the communities and the administration, would be down the drain, and that we would obviously be hit with protracted litigation by probably every community in the state. And the whole question about the state actually transferring these lands to municipalities as originally promised 15 years ago would stay in abeyance probably for, well, however long, maybe 2 years, 2 to 3 years, until the court is finally decided.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to interject for just a second here. Staff has passed out something entitled
work draft paper, committee substitute in House Bill 133. It's my understanding that this suggested committee substitute will be offered by Mr. Schaefer at some point or other. But it doesn't represent, I mean, that's what it represents. It will be a suggested committee substitute. It doesn't represent it. I believe Mr. Haugen was next.
I just want to, I hate to do this, but as I understand it, this percentage was drawn on the voluntarily organized borough lines, that allotment for the first. That represented 10% of the state land within that borough.
Within the borough's municipal boundaries.
They voluntarily organized themselves. Those boroughs that are organized in the state right now, they've been done on a voluntary basis and more in compliance with what the Constitution said.
I believe some may have voluntary. I think others were created under the Mandatory Borough Act that included this legislation as part of its.
So 10% of the state land in that particular area was to revert to that municipality.
That is correct.
So what happened to the land in the unorganized borough?
The law is silent to that. Does not speak for it.
Well, aren't we mandated to draw the borough lines by the Constitution?
I'd have to pass that question.
No, aren't we?
Who do
borough line?
I don't believe
here.
So.
The way I understand that the Constitution says that the Constitutional Convention chose not to draw the borough lines. Then it was said that the legislature will draw the borough lines.
No, the Constitution just says the state will be divided into boroughs. It doesn't say by whom or when.
Well, oh, they shall be. Okay, whose responsibility is it after that? It's either the administration or the legislature, isn't it?
Well, if you read.
Okay, give me the answer to it.
The answer is that when they applied for the borough boundaries, they did it in the same way with the boundary commission as they did the rest of them. The boundary commission either approved or disapproved, and the legislature has the right to act on it. In most cases, they were pliable. The boundary commission, they accepted what was proposed. But that's in some areas, some boroughs, the boundary commission did refuse to include certain areas.
Yeah, but if I recall your borough, you drew your borough lines with the thought in mind that you could administer that area. So your borough was small compared to what other.
Came up 156 acres, obviously we made a mistake.
Yeah, okay, but I mean you were using, but I know, I remember some of these things, but we've got this problem on our hands because it was pretty well understood when we became a state that the borough lines were going to be drawn, but no political body or no administrative body wanted to tackle that question. Isn't that about right? So we're in this jackpot. Now, after the fact, those that are organized aren't satisfied with the first shake, so they're going to go after more. I don't blame them. I do the same thing. But I'm thinking about the short sightedness maybe in our area, but I'm still faulting either the legislature or the administration for not doing it early in the year, because the Constitution clearly says that we'll have boroughs in the state. But I remember the argument about boroughs versus counties, too.
Well, one of the problems with this whole approach, of course, is that you're cutting out what I suppose would have to be regarded as the rights of boroughs to come. Boroughs are going to be formed in western Alaska, or maybe in southeast and other places. They will not have any rights under this act because we're repealing it. I'm sure what will happen is that as soon as they're formed, they'll come to the legislature for a land allotment. I'm sure that's what's going to happen. And we'll have to deal with them on a piecemeal basis that way. I don't think it's very satisfactory, but it may be the only way we can do it. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I think that probably would be the ultimate outcome, but in reality, I think that's going to be the best situation, simply because what we have in front of us now is a manifestation of the problem with trying to estimate what's going to happen in the state growing as rapidly as Alaska with a changing land picture that literally almost changes by the hour. Under existing law, boroughs must come to the legislature after getting local boundary commission approval and lay before the legislature for a period of 60 days. So this is already happening. I think on that case-by-case basis, when the local boundary commission addresses this type of situation, it would be appropriate then to work with the state to determine how much land is now within the boundaries of that borough, what is likely to come, what are their needs, and as opposed to saying, just throwing out a total, say, well, look, there are five major communities in this borough, that's probably where public lands are going to be needed that would go to the borough, and actually identify those type of lands on a specific basis. But if we try to guess now, we're going to have the same problem. We're going to have headaches in the future.
Right, Mr. Bacon.
Well, I'm sort of responding more to Ms. Freeman's comments than I am asking questions, but I don't quite want to respond to what I say, but it seems to me that we might be able to do a thing. I don't know if this is legal, but what if we tried to repeal the old, repeal the old law or ignore it, one of the two, put in our own formula, like the size of the boroughs times the population, get those products of that formula, prorate a distribution of land in the municipalities based on that formula, and then leave it up to the court, and they would get those allotments, like you say the number one would be Anchorage or Fairbanks, they would get the most, and then secondly would be Mat-Su or something like that. But if you didn't come up to the numbers in here, the Mat-Su and other areas that are getting a lot now could go to court, and the court could determine whether or not the contractual provision really was, you know, legitimate and prevailed, and make and mandate that the difference is made up. And we could account for that in the law, saying that if the court does this, then they can apply for reimbursement or for land. But that way we'd have a law going out here that was equitable based on some sort of measures that made sense, and then the court could determine if they wanted to add to those, to what people got, you know, they could.
Chairman, doesn't the legislature make the laws in the first place?
I think that's correct. I think we really have two choices here, or really three choices. I mean, we can go ahead with this type of approach, bearing in mind that perhaps the original legislation was defective and this is the best way to get out from under it, or we can do nothing and set up what I see is a decade of court battles over how much land goes to the boroughs, and the court system moving as slowly as it does. I don't know if people would be all that satisfied with that. Or thirdly, we could wipe the whole thing out and figure out a new plan.
But Mr. Chairman,
I don't know if we'd come up with anything any better than what we've got, but maybe we would.
Mr. Chairman, can't we provide a sort of a severance clause kind of thing? I mean, a lot of times in court cases when there's a dispute, they and I think we could do this, and the court would accept it. We could give whatever the amounts that are agreed upon are, and the parts that aren't, you know, the additional amounts could be litigated. But at least there'd be, you know, we wouldn't have to hold up the whole process of distributing lands to municipalities by. We could say, we could just ignore the whole thing, distribute land to municipalities on a basis of whatever we think is fair. Just do it that way. Just do it whatever we think is fair. And that, that would go. Because we can give more, you're saying we just can't give less. So in the case where we gave more, nobody would dispute it. They wouldn't take it to court. And where we gave less, maybe they'd take it to court. And if they won, they'd get more eventually. But they might have to wait 5 years to get it, but at least they'd have something. You know, Mat-Su might not get 355 or 360 or whatever it is, 1,000 acres this year, but heck, they probably get 150,000, and that's a lot in itself. I don't, you know, it doesn't seem to me like they should get 350,000 in the first place.
I'd like to hear, I don't think that's ever been done, I'd like to hear somebody explain the rationale for not just going ahead and doing it the way the law's on the books right now. I think I know the answer, but nobody's ever had the nerve to stand up and say we should change it for obvious reasons. There's no way as long as you have these large boroughs and the entitlement that they have coming under the existing law, that you're ever going to come out with anything that's equitable. No way, because the land isn't available. And frankly,
even under the proposals that are in this committee substitute. I can't buy it for reasons I'll explain later on, but I would like to know why, you know, somebody tell me what the real push is, except the logical aspirations of the borough governments to get more and more and more, because they want the land, because they, you know, for money. As far as I'm concerned, that's what it's all about. And no, I haven't heard a real reason. The only reason I've ever heard for proposing this bill is because of something that the administration and the municipalities have agreed on would be a good thing. But
that's a very good question, Mr. Freeman. And I would say that, with probably one exception, the administration would agree that this whole particular piece of legislation is not needed, provided legislation is passed which does repeal the existing legislation. What we would do then is we would, on the basis of the agreement we have with all these communities that we've agreed with, we would initiate an agreement with them. And if Mat-Su is down for 355,000 acres, what you have before us is the total based upon our determination of 10%. They obviously agree with it. And we would come to an agreement that that was their entitlement and they would get it. They would not need this legislation. That would work for virtually every municipality, with the exception of those municipalities that have an entitlement but no land.
Yeah.
And in that case is the only hang-up. Now, that could still make the bill much simpler if, in fact, we did two things. One, we repealed the existing legislation, and then secondly, you made some compensation, perhaps the same in lieu, the revenue in lieu formula, which would take care of those. At that point, a lot of the rest of it is not necessarily needed. We would, since we've already had this agreement with the communities, we would operate under that as adopted regulations. The reason we came to the legislature is because, we need to have the act repealed, because if not, this 10% is going to go on forever. We really can't commit land to any type of disposal, because we may find later that the municipality's 10% suddenly jumps up and we owe them that land. The law's still on the book. And secondly, the question about giving a municipality that doesn't have any land something for what can be interpreted as what they should have rightfully had. So those are the two key points.
What do you mean they rightfully should have?
Well, now remember,
the Mandatory Borough Act told them that they would get 10%, right?
Right.
And they made their choice. They made their bet. Now, the question I'm asking, why hasn't somebody, prior administration, this administration, said, here's the law, go get your 10%, and that's all there's to it? Why couldn't you do that? What justification do you have? And I understand the borough's part, but what justification for coming back and say, no, we don't want 5,000 acres, we don't want 1,000 acres, we want 25, 20, 30, whatever.
The figures
other than greed.
The figures you see before you, for the large part, are based on what we would adopt for regulations to interpret the existing law. And most communities have agreed to that. So there would be no disagreement. Only the southeastern communities and North Slope Borough have disagreed with what those figures say. They are the ones that have come in and asked for acreage over and above the 10% figure.
Okay. I agree.
Ms. Rudd, I think, had a question. No.
I'm not sure that I'll shed any light on it, Earl, but one of the problems that's been going on for years is that the 10% figure varies every year, depending on what withdrawals the state has made, what designations for various uses of the land within the boroughs, and whether the state has sold any of that land, so that the 10% figure has not been constant at all in any of the boroughs. It's been different every year, depending on what dispositions the state has made or what designations the state has made of the land. So these figures that are in the bill, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, are the maximum 10% that ever existed in each of the boroughs, then plus some for the southeastern on. But that's been one of the points of contention. Nobody could ever settle on exactly what 10% meant, because it was different every year.
Mr. Green. Well, that was going to be my question to Mr. Smith, and how they figured the 10%. For example, are subsequent annexations and expansions of boundaries after the original law passed, are they included in figuring your 10%?
They are. We maximized for every 6-month period since the act was passed. we took the total amount of state vacant unappropriated unreserved lands within each municipality's boundaries. Some municipalities got bigger. I don't know of any that got smaller. And where that, wherever that peak went, it went up and usually down in most cases, particularly with the passage of the Claim Settlement Act. Most municipalities were hit and impacted by land selections by native corporations, which substantially reduced the state's land title. So we found the highest point for each community, circled that number, and took 10% of that, which we thought was equitable. I mean, in other words, nobody could argue that we were trying to shaft communities by catching with a lower total, because each community had a different 6-month period.
Okay, now, at what date, what are the final criteria for the numbers picked out here? For example, the home site bill, is that net or does that include the home site bill?
As I mentioned, for each, just look, assume a graph with time versus number of acres. For each 6-month period since 1963, for community A, we figure this total. In most communities, that total is somewhere in the late 1960s, which means in 1967 it reaches peak. After that, parks, refuges, Native Claim Settlement Act subtracted from it. If the home site is going to subtract land way out here, maybe 300,000 below its peak. It has no effect on it right now. You can take all the rest of the land away in that community, and we would still say that their entitlement is 10% of this maximum figure.
So under your proposal, as you see it, they have a prior right, let's say a priority to that amount of acreage despite subsequent enactments like the Homestead Bill, the Homestead Initiative, which may pass, and so forth.
Well, the Homestead Initiative,
well, if we don't take action on this,
would specifically override any municipal selection. So if we don't solve it now, it'll be solved for us. In other words, that would, in fact, override municipal selection.
Well, but if there's a legal case that they have a prior existing right to this and we can't repeal it, how can our initiative repeal it?
Well, what you would have to do is somehow make the municipality whole. If you did not have any lands left to give them, you would probably have to perhaps give them something of value. Non-land value.
Well, there's two. Mr. Meekins?
I don't know if I'm going to confuse that. I think there's two aspects. One is the way you find what the 10% of the highest figure. And then there's another problem is whether or not there's land there. That doesn't necessarily mean there's any land there at all. The homestead thing would mean there's no land there, so you'd have to find another way to satisfy the claim, or the claim itself is dependent upon other things besides that.
Right? Okay, wait a minute. Now, Mr. Swanson was having a
question. No, my question was answered then.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to follow that up. Then I understand these figures are the total, the highest allotments that you figure, and your best 10% is here, but you're not saying the land is that much land is available within the municipality.
With only really one exception, it's not available, and that one exception appears to be Anchorage.
Okay, but to the extent that does the home site bill, for example, take priority in your interpretation over that?
The home site, the classification for home site purposes now, as opposed to homestead, these are two terms of art. Okay, with respect to the home site, the lands can be classified for home site under existing classification. At the time it is so classified, it has no effect upon the municipality's entitlement, but it somehow smallly shrinks the pool from within which they can exercise that entitlement.
They get less land, in other words.
No, it doesn't affect what they're entitled to get. It shrinks the pool from within which they can select from.
They get less land, in other words.
No.
If it's a zero sum.
If the pool is 800,000 acres of vacant unappropriated, they're entitled to 300,000. And we take 100,000 away for home site, there's still 700,000 from within which they select their 300,000. So they don't get any less land. It only makes the pool from which they select the lands slightly smaller. The Homestead Initiative would make the pool very much smaller.
Small enough so they wouldn't actually be selecting.
In many cases, there would not be enough land for them to exercise the right.
So you see the home site bill is not actually, they'll still get the land, but they may have to take a swamp or whatever's left.
Different type of land, that's probably the prime
question. Mr. Freeman,
let me be sure that I understood what you said. If this bill passes and the municipalities and boroughs have an entitlement of X number of acres, that entitlement is going to take precedence, isn't it, over the land that possibly could become available for a home site, correct? In other words, the municipality will get their land.
the municipality will get an entitlement, which they have an ability to exercise by making land selections on those lands. If they make land selections on lands which are also identified by us for home site purposes, that's going to have to be an administrative determination as to whether or not we can still meet the mandate of ultimately 25,000 acres for home sites and still give them that land, or whether we have to turn that down, turn the borough down to that selection because we have this other law requiring us to give home sites.
Let me rephrase your question. Do you think that it's logical to assume that if we pass a law that gives the municipality X number of acres of land, that you're going to tell them they can't have that because the department wants to make part of it available for home sites? Is that what you're saying?
I think what we would do is probably go back, in this case to yourself, as a sponsor of the home site bill, to try to determine, explain the situation. In other words, we can come up with the 25,000 acres under the rather strict definition of the home site bill if we can use these acres. However, the communities want to select these acres. Now, if the ultimate disposition is in the private ownership, I think the goal of both is accomplished. The question is, do we come back in 10 years and say, we've given the municipalities the land they wanted, it's in private hands, but because we gave it to the municipalities, we couldn't meet the 25,000 acres in the home site initiative, or the home site bill, I should
say. Yeah, it could be. Let me give you some actual figures here, and then you can tell me what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen, but I want to hear how you explain it. Under the Committee Substitute for House Bill 133, the city and borough of Juneau is allotted 13,600 acres. Your department just recently made a land selection from the National Forest, and when you go through and compute that, a land that was chosen for human habitation, remember, city and borough, you know, 13,600 acres. And when you add up what you people chose, it's 13,669 acres. Are you going to tell me that if we pass this bill and the Forest Service goes along with this allotment, are you trying to tell me that the borough and city and borough of Juneau will not get their 13,600 acres, regardless of what the 69 acres is left?
I don't know if I understand the question, but no, we're not saying that the borough is not going to get their entitlement.
The borough will get their entitlement.
Of course.
I mean, and that'll leave 69 acres.
No.
Find the word entitlement.
First of all, Mr. Freeman, what the borough will get is not limited strictly to settlement lands. I mean, the lands that were selected around the Juneau area were by and large nominated by the community, and they go to other community functions. They include public recreation. Some of them are lands near the Eagle Crest site, the Eagle Crest facility, which they would like to get. And so, in other words, there's a lot more lands, in fact, involved than strictly just lands that are suitable for building homes on. There'd be other community purposes, be it recreation, be it public refuge sites, be it school sites, whatever they might choose to do with it. But this is, I mean, no way are we trying to put to stop one from the other. That's not at all the situation.
Okay, Mr. Swanson.
No, I wanted to know how many actual acres or there was in the home site. One thing, was it 25,000 acres total? That doesn't mean a damn thing when we're talking about 104 million acres of entitled. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a part of a red herring, probably. But on the other thing, I would observe, Mr. Chairman, when I read in the newspaper the entitlements for this borough, it was all recreation sites. It wasn't anything for anybody but the recreation people. It was going to be made into some type of a park.
Mike, go ahead.
No, I'll have something to say after a while.
You know, I think Earl's got a good point there, and with the politics of this session in terms of lands and home site and homesteads and stuff, we're only talking about 25,000 acres, Earl, in terms of all the home site land?
They can build past that.
So, it seems to me that couldn't we give them the home site priority? I mean, we wouldn't mess around with the entitlement to the municipalities. Okay, they got the same entitlement, whatever we decide that is. But in terms of their selection, couldn't we say that the selection has that the home site is a priority, and that the municipal selection has to happen either after the home site is already done, or that it went in conflict, the home site takes precedence? I mean, first of all, the question is, legally, could legislature do that if it desired to?
Sure, there'd be no problem. I think the problem comes in that the home site, the problem we're having with home sites is specifically related to the fact that they're inside, or the problem comes because they are inside the boroughs. for instance, the lands that we are moving now to dispose of under the Homestead Initiative are outside of any existing boroughs, because under what we're required to do under the Homestead Law, we don't fall under or within the constraints of the subdivision laws of the various municipalities. Therefore, they will not let us dispose of Homestead lands now. You would have to, in fact, go back and overrule local planning and zoning authority to allow us to get rid of Homesteads. We're working with the municipalities, hoping that we can get them to agree on some of these, but some of them, quite frankly, have said to us, no.
Well, it seems to me that there's a real possibility there'll be a lot of people, if they hear that this bill, however justifiable, is going to interfere with the home site, or if they can be made to believe anyway that it's going to interfere with the home site, in the land for home sites, that they, you know, won't be very much support for it. So I think we can find language that addresses that problem one way or the other. I mean, I don't know all the ramifications of it, but whatever they are, it seems to me we can give priority to the home site. It's only 25,000 acres. It can't be that much of a contradiction.
Let me perhaps sum up and say that I see almost no conflict between this bill and the Homestead Law. I mean, it just seems that we've kind of generated here in the last 10 minutes. By and large, we can't dispose of home sites in communities under authority they already have. And what we are doing here, well, the chance of there being conflict would be very, very minimal.
Well, Mike, there's no conflict, and it wouldn't hurt to put it in that the home site would take precedence, right?
I have no problem. I've mentioned before, no problem at all.
I mean, but we could do that legally, and we could find language to make it clear that the legislature and we're given their entitlement, and that's something we should do, I guess, but in terms of how they select it, that we have the authority to say that they don't interfere and there should be no conflict with the home site.
That's no problem. You know, it would just be that lands zoned for home sites or suitable for home site purposes would not be selectable. That's no problem.
Okay, Ms. Rudge?
Well, going back to Oral's concern, your concern as to whether or not the municipalities would actually receive the land, wasn't that the
My fear is that they will receive it, there won't be anything left for anything else. And we've changed a landlord, our land shortage has gone from the state in ownership to the municipality.
Well,
simple as that.
Yeah, okay. I would just draw your attention to page 4 of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee substitute, which outlines in some detail the joint planning process that the department and the municipality must go through in order to decide whether the land can actually be selected by the municipality. If in fact there is state interest, strong state interest in certain lands in the municipality, then that land can be withheld from selection by the director, particularly section F, I think, directs to that. And I'm not aware that the committee has ever really looked at that before, but it provides for a system by which the municipality and the state together will reach decisions as to what land is available for selection by the municipalities and what land is not because of overriding state interest.
Now, Mike, does the city of Valdez have any rights under the existing legislation?
Yes, they do, Mr. Chairman.
That's a pretty big outfit. What about them?
Okay, I'm trying to recall now. This, under our interpretation, well, first of all, the city has already been approved approximately 4,000 acres that they already have, and that is 10% of the maximum they can appropriate unreserved. I mean, they're one of the ones that are right on target. With there's no problem with them one way or the other.
Okay, what happens if they expand their borders as they're trying to do? They're heading up there towards Glen Allen. What happens there? Do you just give out some more land according to, depending on how much more they pick up in an annexation?
Under the existing law, if the community expands their boundaries, technically, depending on where we are in the process, their 10%, their base figure might go higher, depending on other land statuses in the borough. In the case of Valdez, I would think if they suddenly annexed all the way up to Glen Allen, they would probably take in enough state land such that total would increase. Under the bill, HB 133 before you, they would be, as of the date of the act, their entitlement would be established. If in our response would be, what I hear your question leading to is, what other future land needs might they have, that is, we have the capability of handling that situation, and that's also built into the legislation. that we can continue under the existing authority, 315, transfer lands to communities without any upper limit for public purposes that they may need land for.
Are there other entities beside the city of Valdez that are not included in the purview of this bill that would continue to receive land, presumably if the law stayed in effect?
Well, technically, any municipality is defined. If this present law stays in effect, to the extent that they could expand their borders and not run into another municipality, you know, would increase, in fact, their 10% figure. If there's any state land within their borders.
Okay.
They could just annex those parts of state land that are vacant, unreserved, unappropriate, 10% of it.
What?
That would probably happen.
What difficulties do you see in allowing a municipality to choose land outside their borders as distinguished from giving them cash?
That, I think, is something that's up to the municipalities. The basic concept, I think, that we've all operated on is that the purpose of trying to come up with a settlement within the confines of existing legislation is to provide municipalities with a land base within their borders with which they can serve the various needs of their people. And certainly a community which suddenly winds up as landowner inside another community's boundaries has nothing but a piece of land subject to the same classification and zoning authorities, whatever, of the other municipality. They become a landowner. It has no direct public benefits other than perhaps as a financial basis.
But if the purpose is to convey to the community land that they can use to serve as a base, you're paying cash. You're making in lieu payments to certain municipalities anyway. So, you know, that purpose apparently works for certain municipalities and for others who are disgruntled with the fact that there's not enough land within their borders and they get money. As to those communities, what would be wrong from a policy standpoint, the standpoint of state policy, with allowing those communities, for instance, to choose land outside the borders existing borough? In other words, the federal government owns land in Alaska. They have title to land in Alaska. What would be wrong with the municipality owning title to land?
Okay, this is hitting me cold. I haven't had too much time to think about it. Federal land basically operates under the Supremacy Clause. They can pretty much do what they want to do with it. This land, as one example of the difference, this land would not be able to do that. The borough that owned the land, or the municipality that owned the land in some other municipality, is nothing other than a landowner. It has no more authority over it than any private corporation. Secondly, I could see, particularly where the municipality who has the planning and zoning authority decides, for either political reasons or for whatever reasons, that it wants to zone, set up some type of classification which would prevent development of that land, thereby definitely have an economic impact upon the other municipality. You have an intermunicipality feud, which ultimately would have to be probably settled in the legislature as the only body that could essentially handle that. There are representatives here from some of the municipalities that might be involved. If you might want to listen further comment, they might be able to explain more cogently some of their problems.
Well, that's all. I don't.
It was. Let me say this. It was thought about in the past, discussed, and discarded by all concerned. It's made it somewhat impractical.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, how many of these 1 through 11 or 12 that are in contention are not satisfied? Do you have any kind of reading?
My understanding is that the only municipality that's going to be getting in-lieu cash payments would be Anchorage and perhaps the North Slope Borough if the court decides that the North Slope Borough's entitlement higher than the state
intends.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Although I think what Mr. Swanson is asking of the entitlements under Section 202, which municipalities do not agree with the specific entitlement they have, whether
right.
It's in lieu or not. In that case, again, I have to defer you to the municipality itself, Mr. Swanson, but the only municipality that is on record as against this, I would say, would be the North Slope Borough.
I heard you know that. We'll get to that.
Now, on this fiscal note that you wrote to, it's a letter of May 477, trying to setting out the in lieu payments. It shows a maximum, let's see, $39 million and a minimum of $12 million through 79 through 80, fiscal year 80. Is that all for Anchorage? Does that include North Slope and the other possible in lieu selections?
Okay, that included others, and I have a letter today for the committee which updates that on the basis of changes that have occurred since last year. In fact, I can hand it out right now if you'd like to see it. Yeah. It lowers those figures substantially.
Maybe you could explain why it's lower.
Certainly. The difference between those two are based primarily upon the work that we have done during the interim since the end of last session in determining exactly which communities might in fact have a problem with getting their full entitlement. Last year when we were asked to put this together, we gave a maximum figure to make sure that if the legislature did act, they were not acting on information which might turn out to be low. And on that basis, we came up with the figures you saw. The revised figures list the same minimum, which we were fairly sure would be a minimum last year, but reduce the maximum down from a total of about $39 million to a total of about $16.5 million. Last year at this time, it was our estimate that Kodiak Borough might not have enough land within its boundaries to meet their entitlement. We have now determined that they have ample land to meet their entitlement.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
So this maximum of 16.5 is based on essentially payments to Anchorage?
To Anchorage and, I just have to say, a fudge factor. In other words, there might be some other small communities, and we're talking about ones now that may have 200 or 300 acres. We haven't determined those yet, because it's going to be a large job that might in fact be in that situation. Anchorage would receive the lion's share of this total, probably, and depending upon exactly the form that the bill is finally passed in the neighborhood of 10, perhaps 12 million over a long period. We're working with the community because they have indicated they are much more interested in land than they are in money. And of course, we feel that we should be able to transfer to them virtually any land that is within the municipality that is not of greater than local significance, which is very minimal. The municipality has its own capabilities to manage lands, and we would have preferred it to exchange or transfer them to them in the maximum amount possible. I might add that this new letter dated today's date, February 15th, is based upon two assumptions. One is that the projection or the entitlements as listed in CSHB 133 are in fact finally enacted. And secondly, that the lands we just selected from the Forest Service will come to the state by 1984, so that they would be therefore available for selection by the southeastern municipalities. We feel that the latter will occur.
Okay. Are there other questions, at least for now, for Mr. Smith? Because we do have other persons who want to testify on the bill. I would assume Mr. Smith will hang in there for a while. Russ, did you have another question?
Yeah, it's just a short one.
Okay.
Mike, is there any provision here? What can the municipalities do with land? Anything? I mean, is there any limitations on it?
Aside from land, certain agricultural lands, the land would be transferred in fee simple title to the surface estate of all those lands. And the agricultural provision simply says that if it is agricultural land, they receive the agricultural rights to those lands.
What about oil and mineral rights?
Mineral rights are always reserved to the state under the Statehood Act. They never were part of this. It's not part of the question involved.
Okay, so the municipality could, if it wants, sell the land to me and I could buy it, but I still wouldn't have rights to it.
To the subsurface, no.
Okay.
I have another
Mr. Rhodes.
Well, in short, Mike, this to me, a substitute for House Bill 133, then essentially it is to satisfy a commitment made under the Mandatory Borough Act?
That's correct.
Is it essentially right?
In a nutshell, that's a good summary we come up with.
Green. Are the 20,000 acres set out for the Anchorage Borough, is any of that available for actual land selection?
Approximately 6,700 acres has already been either transferred or approved to the Anchorage municipality, so they actually have working title to that. Another approximately 6,700 acres does exist, and we assume that virtually all of that will in fact go to the Anchorage municipality.
So they'll be taking payments in lieu of land to about 8,000?
That is exactly the figure I use as a maximum. We may be able even to work that smaller, depending upon some other discussions that we're trying to come up with, the ability to transfer even more land to them.
Okay, how is the figure of $1,500 an acre arrived at? That would, if that were the amount available or that they were required to take in lieu of...
The figures were arrived at there, again, on the basis of concurrence between the state and the municipalities involved. We made certain revenue projections, et cetera, and came up with a determination that that figure for the number of acres that might be exchanged for in lieu was something that the general fund would be able to handle. The amounts are weighted like that so that the communities with smaller amounts of entitlement would in fact get more in lieu payment for a given set of acres, whereas a community that might have a huge entitlement, when you get down to the lower acreages, would receive less. The feeling being, of course, that...
There is no municipality, as I understand it, that's going to be receiving over 10,000.
That's correct. At the time this was written, it appeared that Kodiak might be in that situation. As it is established now, it does no harm if nobody does. If, in fact, a large entitlement is somehow put in here for another community, that might well kick it up substantially.
Mr. Bacon, I brought up another question now. What, did you see the amendment proposed by the mental health amendment?
Yes.
They said that there was some mental health land, and you know, if the mental health board approved it, they could swap it. If that happened, would that make any substantial amount of land available for selection on the Anchorage?
No, it wouldn't. We were just talking about that before the meeting. We'd have to check, but it would be insignificant. I doubt it would be over, what would you say, 300 to 500 acres at maximum?
For mental health.
Very good land. Oh, yeah, it's very good land, but it is certainly...
500 out of the 8,000?
Yes, it is not a significant portion of it.
But it'd be valuable for the municipality, but it doesn't really do anything to the whole total in terms of...
That's right.
...of any payments.
Mr. Green. I received a letter from the chairman of the mental health board. Now, I was looking through this committee substitute. I didn't see a provision in there to allow a swap where the municipality has selected mental health lands, for example. Do you favor provision in this committee substitute to allow that?
We would be willing to add a mandatory language to this bill, which would permit the selection of mental health lands by certain municipalities, as long as those lands were selected under the same criteria that lands are selected, that general grant lands are selected, i.e. the lands are suitable for local purposes, and there's no greater statewide interest, that the particular lands being selected would be approved by the mental health board, and then the state Division of Lands would be responsible for substituting other replacement lands to the mental health land trust, you might say, in return for it. The certain municipalities that we talk about would be limited to those municipalities that are required to go under the revenue in lieu of, or the payment, or the revenue in lieu of land proposal. In other words, a community that has ample lands within its boundaries to select lands would not be able to select mental health lands. Those communities that in fact did not would be able to on a replacement basis. And this would essentially apply, how it would come out practically is it would apply to Anchorage, and it would probably apply to the southeast communities that would be involved until such time as the state receives title to the southeast forest selections, which will probably be a couple of years. That would give the southeast communities before that the ability to select those trust lands.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any further questions of Mr. Smith, but I do have some amendments that accomplish this, allow a transfer or swap of mental health lands, and I'd like to leave a copy of it. Mr. Smith, maybe you could look at it.
I think that would be in order because...
Plus, I'll get copies of the thing for everybody.
That's fine.
May I ask a question? Is this the same information, the same language, mandatory language that was presented, I believe, to the committee about 2 weeks ago?
Yeah. I don't know, I don't have it in my file. It's not just the amending of the title, it's a...
It's a two-page...
Two-page amendment.
We have looked at that.
Oh, okay.
And the administration's position on that is that with respect to the first part of that, what you just discussed, yes, we can suggest that we've been working on our own language for that, which we think will handle that situation. With respect to the second part of that, which would go totally out of the context of municipal land selections and begin to talk about the establishment of a mental health lands trust board with certain management responsibilities, the administration opposes that aspect. That is a very detailed question that needs to be worked on, but not, we feel, in the context of the municipal land selection.
What difference does it make?
Well, that particular language would create two management agencies within the state. In other words, it would totally remove, it would establish a trust board where there is a very good legal question whether any trust board is required by any law. And secondly, it would totally remove, essentially, from the management by the Department of Natural Resources, the entire trust lands of the mental health board.
I think what you're saying is that the governor would like to veto it, and he doesn't want to veto the municipal lands bill. That'll remain my observation.
I'd observe, too, that the amendments only require approval by the board, not necessarily another management system. In other words, you lose some of your jurisdiction is what the only thing I see. It doesn't mean that you don't not involved in the management for the swap. It's just that this board, as the Board of Education does for school lands, will have to approve it. I don't see anything matter with that.
We have no problem if you're talking about an exchange of land to allow a municipality to select. We completely agree with that. And the language we've been working on allows the what is called the Mental Health Board, although there's no statutory name, to do that. We have no problem with that. We think they should. But that the ramifications of other aspects of that language go far beyond what they were really, we feel, trying to do, and certainly does not address the municipal land selection question.
Okay. Are there further questions of Mr. Smith on this bill at this time? I know questions will arise later on. All right, if not, I'd like to thank you, Mike, for appearing here, and the show will go on, of course. There are apparently four other witnesses who wish to testify. My intention would be to take them in alphabetical order. Mr. Burns, Anchorage, did you want to address the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ted Burns, the municipal attorney for the municipality of Anchorage. I'd just like to make a few comments on some of the discussion that came out of Mr. Smith's presentation. Anchorage has and continues to support committee substitute for House Bill 133 as produced by the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. These figures, in terms of the entitlements, were worked out through a series of meetings over the course of a year between the state and at least most of the municipalities that appear on this list. Maybe I could give you a bit of history about Anchorage's situation in this matter. Anchorage, perhaps it may be alone now among the boroughs, finds itself in the uncomfortable situation of having at one time had an entitlement that reached to 20,865 acres, but because of a number of occurrences, predominantly the creation of the state park, we find ourselves with no available land to select, or no appreciable amount of land to select that will really come very close to meeting this figure. At the same time, Anchorage is involved as a very rapidly growing community. It's involved in an aggressive land acquisition program for a variety of public needs, and of course I don't need to tell the committee how valuable land is in the Anchorage Bowl and how much money the taxpayers' dollars is being spent to acquire it. This bill would, at least in perhaps a small way, attempt to provide what lands are available in the Anchorage Bowl for municipal selection and provide an in-lieu payment system to perhaps assist Anchorage in its land acquisition programs, where it has to go out and buy land from private landholders for park purposes or other municipal uses.
Mr. Chairman, while we're on that, what land could be available at $1,500 an acre in the Anchorage area? I just don't know of any land.
The $1,500 an acre was never intended to be an actual acre-for-acre dollar value as far as what we could go out and buy land for. It was frankly worked out with the state as sort of what they felt was a reasonable amount that we could get. We don't think we can get any more. We'd be happy to take more, of course, if we think we could get it. Obviously, no one can buy land in the Anchorage Bolton's Rip very much for about $1,500 an acre. We're hopeful, by the way, that one of the big benefits of this bill will be not necessarily the dollars that will flow from it, but that it will speed up the selection process and the approval process for those acres of land that are available in the Anchorage Bolton. And we've been working with Mr. Smith's office to try to identify those acres that may, in fact, be subject to municipal selection. And this bill would unfreeze the process and allow that to go forth to get us what land we can. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to review in detail the amendment relating to the mental health lands, but from my group review of it, we support that very strongly. There are some very valuable lands within the bowl that fall into that category. I'd also like the committee, perhaps you in particular, Mr. Green, to consider the matter of school lands along the similar lines, whereby perhaps school lands that are held in trust could be exchanged in return for lands of equal value somewhere else. There is an appreciable amount of land that falls in that category within the Anchorage Bowl. We may be talking perhaps up to 2,000 acres worth of land. So I would encourage the committee to explore that alternative, and I'd be happy to offer whatever assistance I could. I understand there may be some questions as to whether school lands would be subject legally to the same type of exchange mechanism. I'd like to respond, I think, to a couple of comments that Mr. Meekins made as far as, well, why don't we just let's go into the courts and see what happens. The impact on Anchorage of that, quite frankly,